Welcome back to The Bulwark Coast of Hollywood. My name is Sonny Bunch. I'm culture editor at The Bulwark, and I'm very pleased to be joined today by Abe Goldfarb. Now, Abe, you've got a new movie out. We're going to talk about that in a minute here. You are also currently on tour with the Beetlejuice the Musical show. You're actually in Dallas. We're doing this from a... People will notice. There's an echo in this room. We're doing it in a different room because I have, for the first time, brought somebody to my lair... to have their life discussed. Thanks for being on the show, Abe.
Oh my gosh, thank you so much for having me. Thrilled to be in Dallas, thrilled to be here with you. And yeah, man, let's get into it.
So, all right, let's start at the beginning, or at least as far back as you want to go. How did you find yourself in the world of musical theater? What was the start for you?
Well, I mean, gosh, I guess that summer camp in high school, it's where it started. You know, Bucks Rock summer camp, and then the Putney School up in Vermont, which is on a farm. And I was always kind of a theater kid, but there was this derelict barn that a bunch of us renovated with the school's help into being their theater. They didn't have a theater. They had an assembly hall. But we all just sort of went to work and turned this thing into a makeshift theater, and it was amazing. Now they have an actual, like, full-on arts complex. But back then, that was the most exciting thing. But then I went to theater school in the UK, the Bristol Old Vic, for 3 years, which was an intensive program, 8:45 to 7, 5 days a week. And when I came back, I just got after it. 20s were a dead loss. 30s, I started doing my, like, commercial work, voiceover work, and a little bit more musical theater. Mm-hmm. And I've always been doing burlesque hosting, which is so much sort of vaudeville music hall style. And that, I think, prepped me in really major ways for doing big stage musical theater, working with these giant rooms full of unruly drunks and having to be heard and understood and corral them. But we'll get to
one of those in a bit. Folks may remember there was some drama surrounding a Beetlejuice the Musical performance. So, all right, so you do all this, and then you're in the ensemble for Beetlejuice the Musical
and the Winter Garden when we opened in 2019. I was understudying every single male role. Mm-hmm. Beetlejuice, Charles, Adam, Maxie, and Otho. And then, you know, the show shut down at the top of the pandemic. It came back to the Marriott Marquis, and that production, they slimmed the ensemble down, so my part didn't exist. Mm-hmm. But then not long after that, they were like, well, we're doing a tour. And they had me in to see me for Otho, so now I've got this lovely featured role that I get to goof around in every single night.
Folks who have seen the movie will remember Otho as the kind of, how would you describe him? Well,
he's quite different in the film than he is in the show.
Okay.
In the film, he's Delia's interior designer, mm-hmm. and he's played by the great Glenn Shadix, mm-hmm. an amazing character actor, gone far too soon. Also, out and proud, a long time before that was really the norm, mm-hmm. But a regular in Tim Burton's work. Great portrait photographer as well. If you ever want to look up his photos, he took a bunch of amazing pictures on the set of Beetlejuice. Mm-hmm. Catherine O'Hara, Beau Welch, all these great people. Beautiful black and white shots. But in the film, he's this kind of snippy, droll, deadpan interior designer. And in the show, which is very vastly rewritten from the film, mm-hmm. He's Delia's sort of new age guru.
Okay.
And in effect, a bit of a cult leader. And a bit more of a flamboyant character. It's kind of good that we're not doing the same thing mm-hmm. as the film. The film is canonical. It's an acknowledged classic. You're never going to do that better. So I think when you're adapting, it's important to be like, the original is always going to be there. Let that be that.
Yeah.
Let's actually do some rethinking and think, all right, well, what stuff that they didn't do in the original that we could take this core concept and kind of boost it and do some off-center stuff, and I think they've done it really, really well with the show.
Well, run folks through it then. So I'll be honest, I have not seen it. I've not been able to make it.
But you've seen the film.
But I've seen the film.
Sure.
So I know the movie. I know. Yeah. So what are some of the differences? What should folks be expecting if they come?
Well, in the film, you get 15 minutes of Beetlejuice. Mm-hmm. You know, he's very much a kind of he's seasoning mm-hmm. in the film. You know, he gooses it. In the show, he's front and center. He's your narrator. He's basically breaking the fourth wall, talking with the audience, ragging on audience members, you know, commenting on the action. Very much a Bugs Bunny kind of character. Mm-hmm. But the central thrust of it in the musical is that at the beginning, Lydia, the teenage girl, her mother has just died. And it opens at the funeral of Emily Dietz. And Beetlejuice then sort of arrives, disrupts the funeral, and he has this like Disney I want moment of like, I just want to be seen. And Lydia is the same way. She feels invisible. Her father is trying to carry on with his life. He's into this new woman, Delia, who's an employee and secretly his lover. Mm-hmm. And the Maitlands are this happy family that live in this house. They die in a horrifying little accident, which is very different on stage. And it's all about essentially Lydia being caught between these three groups, you know, like Lydia's dad, who she feels is uncaring and distant. The Maitlands, who are well-meaning and milquetoast and can't really do the ghoulish things she wants them to do. And Beetlejuice, mm-hmm. who is a dangerous, chaotic agent and very much her opposite number. And the show becomes a bit of a frenemy relationship between the two of them.
Yeah, that's interesting. So let me ask, do you ever get audience members who are annoyed that it is different from they showed up expecting, I want the beat for beat retelling of the Beetlejuice myth and all this deviation.
First of all, get outside, touch grass, grow up. But we have had very few people like that. I had a friend whose dad came and saw the show who was like, he was really pissed because he loves the movie. Well, I love the movie too. And I've seen it.
Yeah.
You know, for the most part, the fans of this show and the audience for it are younger people whose relationship with Beetlejuice has been formed by this show. Hmm. A lot of them came to the movie after the musical or mm-hmm. haven't even seen the film. You know, so we have people coming in cosplay from the show.
Yeah.
Rather than the film. Older audience members tend to come dressed up a little bit closer to the film.
Yeah.
But no, for the most part, people are really, really thrilled about what it is rather than what it isn't, which I think is very encouraging, especially for the future of musicals that are being adapted from old films. It's never going to stop happening, but let's not do the thing where we just give you the stuff you like and throw some songs in.
Yeah.
Let's actually have a creative interpretation of the material. And Scott Brown and Anthony King are book writers, and Eddie Perfect are composer and lyricist, have done a beautiful job. They capture the vibe, but it's not a direct and immediate retelling of the film.
Yeah, that's great. I'm curious to get your take on Broadway before and after the pandemic, because mm-hmm. I do feel like there's been, you know, there's been a lot of talk about the recovery and getting people back and, you know, what has changed, what hasn't, you know, as somebody who was there before, during, and after, what's the vibe like right now?
Well, I mean, it's sort of a steroidal version of the question about cinemas, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, because as much as keeping movie theaters open was tough and bringing people back was tough, it's much harder when your average seat costs like, you know, $100.
Right.
It's a luxury item. And one thing that the pandemic did was essentially be like, yeah, don't worry about the luxury items. Like, leave that in the past. Broadway, I think, is still adapting and still finding a way to bring people back. You know, it was already a nightmare putting mm-hmm. a show up on Broadway. You don't do it if you want to make money.
Right.
You know, you do it either for prestige or, you know, you're a prospector. You're like, maybe there's gold there, you know. But it's very much a business of patronage. And I don't know, man. I think what's changed is people are definitely a little bit less likely to buy a ticket. You have to do a lot more legwork to bring people back,
mm-hmm.
you know, to get them into that theater. And there's plenty of shows that were sure things that just didn't do the business. And the stuff that is doing the business, very surprising. Mm-hmm. The show post-pandemic that has been the biggest, to my mind, success story was Kimberly Akimbo, which is an intimate, small-scale, very human-scale musical
mm-hmm.
Based on a play from like 20 years ago by David Lindsay Abaire. It's a gorgeous show, but it's nobody's idea of a spectacle. It's not based on an IP that people are very familiar with.
Yeah.
So again, I mean, maybe it's just plus a change, you know, plus LMM shows, you know. Now, more than ever, nobody knows what's going to work. But nobody knew it was going to work before.
Yeah. Well, that's... Yeah,
nobody knows anything.
Exactly. You know, as you say, what is true for Hollywood is almost doubly true for Broadway. And that's it. All right. So now you guys are on tour. What is tour life like for a big Broadway production? You know, I want to know what is your weekly schedule like, your bi-weekly schedule. You know, you roll into town, you get all set up at the hotel.
Yeah.
You know, how does that work?
Well, usually we're in for 1 week.
Okay.
So we don't really get a day off.
Mm-hmm.
Monday is a travel day, and we roll in and we're just exhausted. Tuesday, you know, you go in for mic checks and just, you know, they have to load everything into the theater, and then Tuesday night you're just up. And the rest of the week, you know, I mean, we're doing 8 shows.
Mm-hmm.
We did 9 shows this week in Dallas because we threw in an 11 a.m. Student matinee, and they were fucking raucous. But yeah, it's oddly enough, the only thing that doesn't change is the show. You know what I mean? You're in there Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday night, Saturday afternoon, Saturday night, Sunday afternoon, Sunday night. The rest of it, you know, there are people who, like, they go antiquing, they go to museums, they go and see the sights, you know, and I do a lot of walking around. You know, I like to scope things out, check out, drink in the local culture. But I mean, also a lot of my time is spent writing and going to the movies. That's kind of my church, is the movie theater. That's the closest I've got to a place of worship. It's just at least once a week. If I don't want to lose my mind, I've got to go to the movies.
Yeah.
And I've got an Alamo Drafthouse season pass.
Good.
So in Texas, I've gotten to really, really give that a solid workout.
You definitely, there's plenty of places. If I know, I think I know basically where you guys are staying, and you're kind of equidistant from two different ones. There's actually one right up here, Lake Highlands.
Right. We're right by the Cedars. We're like 2 miles.
You're near the Cedars. Yeah,
like 2 miles from the Cedars.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a nice one. I like.
It's very, very nice.
I like Cedars.
Yeah.
But they
changed their projector bulbs. It's amazing.
Oh, that's, I went to, I won't name the chain, but I went to see Drive Away Dolls last week.
It was Dim Projector.
And it was like, I was sitting, I made a foolish choice. I sat all the way in the back, despite the fact that it was a mostly empty theater. I should have sat closer up. But it was like watching it through a cloud.
Which is insane, because it's a colorful pop movie. You know, it's got visuals that really, really just...
Yeah.
And the idea of, like, seeing that through a film of, whatever, like, you know, mosquito netting. It's just...
The worst.
Yeah, and that's a movie that, such a big part of why I enjoyed it was seeing it on a screen where, like, the colors just leapt out. It's almost, you know, psychedelic, three-dimensional.
Yeah,
That's a damn shame.
It was. It was too bad. I'm excited to check it out again whenever it hits home video.
It's certainly the most pussy-eating I've seen in a wide-release movie ever.
I will say, it's for you... The Coen brothers aren't exactly staid. They're not exactly, but it's never been quite like this. I mean, even there's more sex in this than even in The Big Lebowski, which is at least partly about the porn business.
Yeah. Well, this is, you know, Ethan Coen. It's his solo venture with his wife Trisha Cook, and it's very much based on her experiences in queer bars, like in the late '90s, early 2000s. There's a reason it's set in the year that it is. But I found it so interesting to watch Joel Coen's Macbeth and Ethan Coen's Drive Away Dolls and just be like, the division of labor could not be clearer, right?
Yeah. Well, you definitely see it's...
Suddenly you've got like, okay, well, we know who's composing these immaculate frames
exactly.
And we know who's writing this deranged, curly-cue kind of dialogue.
It's very funny to watch both of those you know, movies separately and then go back and watch something like No Country for Old Men or Fargo or... you know, The Big Lebowski, or just like, there's like, oh yeah, I can see you just to start doing this weird cultural anthropology, and you don't want to put too much stock in it because.
But their skill sets are on very stark display in these different films. And if you want to play that game, yes, you can absolutely. I haven't seen Ethan Coen's documentary about Jerry Lee Lewis, though, and I'm very curious.
I haven't seen that one. No.
It's all archival footage. Yeah. I hear it's wonderful.
Yeah. All right, so you go to the theaters. That's great.
Yeah.
So when you're rolling into a new stage, just what is the actual like physical production like? I mean, is it just the same everywhere? Because stages are basically stages.
Yeah. Or... Essentially.
Yeah.
I mean, weirdly enough, the big thing that changes is what's the floor made of.
Mm-hmm.
That affects the movement entirely.
How so?
Well, depending on the sort of like the constitution of the floor, what's coating it, you know, like its level of hardness or yield, you've got people doing crazy dancing all over that stage. And so it really does matter what's underfoot.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's the big chaotic factor. You know, other than that, there's obviously like local crews and what, you know, their workflow. But for the most part, the show is it's pretty modular. You kind of just put it in wherever. It's always the same width. It's always the same height. You know, and so far it's fit really beautifully into all these theaters.
No, it's fun. All right. So where you're in Dallas right now, but by the time this goes up, you guys are going to be out of Dallas.
That's
so
right.
Where are you?
We're doing anti-promotion.
if you live in Dallas, you're screwed. But luckily, this is a national show. So where are you guys headed next?
After this, we're going to Houston.
Okay.
And then Nashville, Tennessee. And that's the next 2 weeks of the tour. Okay.
And then I think Atlanta after that.
Atlanta, right? that's correct. Right. In Georgia. It's going to be an incredible, incredible ride, I think.
Fun swing through the big southern states.
And for a cities. For a Brooklyn hipster, I mean, this is all very illuminating.
Yeah. Have you been to down here before?
I have. Well, you know, the first time I rolled through was over 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. I was in a really terrible musical of The Little Prince. And it was partially in French. And I didn't speak any, so they gave me the most ridiculously... I had one line in French. I played the aviator, sort of the narrator of the show. And the only line I had to say in French was, oh yes, the baobabs. I said, ah oui, the baobab. And it was a terrible, terrible show, filled with misadventure, very cheaply mounted, and so much drinking. And so my memories of the Southlands are actually fairly fuzzy.
Yeah, that's fair.
But this is the first time, I suppose, as like a grown-ass adult that I've gotten to come through and really soak it up and enjoy it.
It's fun. There's plenty of places to eat.
Well, there's so much music. There's so much food. It's gorgeous. And so much local art.
Yeah.
You know,
Dallas has some great museums. I mean,
yes, it does.
Like Dallas and Fort Worth, both. If you're not going out to Fort Worth, there's no reason to go out to Fort Worth. But if you did, they have good museums as well. All right. So one thing we have to discuss. This became news.
Yes.
This was a huge story. So I'm sitting there just looking at Twitter one day, and I see that Lauren Boebert, the congresswoman from Colorado,
ah oui, le Boebert,
has been kicked out of a musical, and I'm like, got kicked out of a musical? Who gets kicked out of a musical? And we saw why, and then I was like, oh wait, I know one person in one musical in this country, and it's this one. How did that happen? All right, so give us the background here. What happened?
Okay, so the first we heard about it was after the show. We had no idea it was happening during the show. Because, you know, I mean, the crowds are anywhere from 2,000 to 3,500 people. It's, you don't see them, you know, and you can barely hear them.
Yep.
Unless they're laughing in unison or clapping. So we had a party celebrating our 500th show that night. We all go to this bowling alley. And the merch people come in. We got these amazing people who travel with us selling the merch. And if you really want the shit, like the straight dope, you talk to people who work merch or front of house. They know everything. And so they come in just smiling uncontrollably, like, hey, what's up with you guys? And they're like, you're not going to believe this. I was like, what? And they're like, you know Lauren Boebert? And I was like, yeah, regrettably I do. They're like, yeah, she caused a huge disturbance and got kicked out. And they were like, they said, you know, well, she was brought out in the lobby. She was fuming at the management at the front of house. And she had a boyfriend there. He looked really tired. and she gets escorted out. She's saying that she's going to call the police about this horrible situation, this terrible, unjust mistreatment. And as the doors close on her, she says, you can't do this to me. I'm a United States congressperson. So it's the ultimate, do you know who I am? The genius thing is, the details start coming out about what she actually did, which is to say, she was getting handsy with her boyfriend in the seat. She was vaping right next to a pregnant woman who asked her to stop, and she then yelled at this pregnant woman. She was singing along to the tunes, which, you know, if you're at a concert, sure, but if you're at a musical, by and large, you want to hear the people on stage doing it.
Right.
And she was asked to leave. She got escorted out, and she was livid about it. And the genius thing is, she denied every slow drip of information about what she had done. What she did not perhaps realize is that the theater that we were playing in was a federal building, which means every bit of video from those cameras is subject to a Freedom of Information request. So every time she said, well, that's not true. Someone like, click, 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 click. They put in an application. They got the video. Yeah. And they're like, you did, though. It's right here. And somehow our show was national news for a week. Yeah. It was deranged. And I'll tell you, I mean, it didn't hurt the sales.
I imagine.
But we did get our producers were like, it's okay to link to the story. Do not do any commentary on it, please. I think a big part of that was a lot of her supporters are very vitriolic and have a lot of guns.
Well, you don't want to, hey, look, and you don't want it to turn into a political football. Nobody wants that.
No.
Like, because, and here's, and this is, I want to make a very explicit point here. This is not a partisan issue.
No!
This is a behavioral issue.
That's right.
Like you, if you are...
This is how you were raised, goddammit.
This is a thing I very firmly believe. And it's, we discussed the Alamo Draft House. That's why I like going to the Draft House, because they have very strict rules about how you behave.
That's right.
In theater. And then if you are just out there causing a ruckus, you're messing it up for everybody else.
Get out. No, listen, if... Acting like a total jagoff is not a partisan issue. I will say that happily.
No.
But yeah, no, it's weird. Theater is one of those last sort of bastions where you're like, well, people understand that there are codes of conduct here. Mm-hmm. Apparently not.
Yeah.
I think she was under the misapprehension that this was like a concert. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Or she was insanely shwasted.
Vaping in public. Can't be. That's
don't,
never.
And in a closed space, don't be that. A dick.
Don't do that.
Yeah, the little tidbit I was most surprised. Well, one of the tidbits I was most surprised by.
A lot of bits.
Was the singing along.
Yes.
Which suggests to me that she is a big fan.
That's
of the show.
The insane thing.
Is it she showing up here and singing along and, you know.
Clearly she knew the songs. Yeah. She's got the album. Like, that's wild to me that Lauren Boebert. This show, I mean, listen, obviously, we're not talking about the political football aspect of just, you know, who did this, what party they were from. But this is somebody who is, in a lot of her public speaking, pretty anti-queer. This show's gay as hell. Mm-hmm. There is so much dude-on-dude making out in this show and innuendo and so much sort of filth and vulgarity. And it's like, you're one of those people who's like, our children need to be protected from this kind of shit. And you're in a theater... You know, massaging a guy's junk in front of a pregnant woman. Like, I'm sorry, dude.
Yeah.
You know, come on. I'm not asking you to be the world's greatest Samaritan, but I'm saying maybe exhibit a trifle of consistency.
It's very funny. The whole thing was very funny. And again, it was like, wait, I know exactly one musical theater person.
And it happened to be me.
In this play. So I'm glad we could get you on the show when you're here.
Me too.
In Dallas.
I assure you, were it a Democrat behaving like this, I would be similarly amused.
I would hope so. Because it's just bad behavior. That's you know, we have norms for a reason. They transcend partisan boundaries.
Like, grow up. It's not Heartbreak Point. You're not out there.
So this is one thing I very firmly believe. All right. So let's shift from musical theater to the world of independent cinema.
Yes.
First time caller. I wrote about it in my newsletter a couple weeks back. I want to talk about the making, the genesis, and all that, and also again shooting during the pandemic, which is a whole nother kettle of fish, and everything else. But how did you get involved with First Time Caller? Okay. Hey, tell people what First Time Caller is.
Okay,
if they haven't read my newsletter or seen the movie.
First Time Caller, in its simplest pitch, is a science fiction disaster movie set entirely in an asshole's basement. It is about a sort of an internet radio host who's kind of an alpha dog, you know, pickup artist, provocateur, you know, libertarian, both sides are idiots, only I know what's right kind of guy. And he receives a call from someone who makes a terrifying prediction, and his predictions start coming true. And the film is about 95% real time of just this guy in his home studio on the phone with someone who is delivering terrifying news. The genesis came at the beginning of the pandemic. It was, I think, May of 2020. And I got a friend, Mac Rogers, brilliant writer. He wrote my first directorial feature, The Horror at Gallery K. which was so commercial. It was a black and white lesbian romantic horror fantasy.
Sure.
You know, it was big bucks.
So it was right at the top of Box Office Mojo.
Exactly.
What for that?
We
category?
Made dozens. Dozens! But yeah, no. This is, by comparison, a Michael Bay picture. Mm-hmm. But I had an anxiety dream in May. I was having tons of them at the time. And it was about a guy who was alone in a house doing a sort of live stream, receiving a call from someone who made a terrible prediction. And I immediately texted Mac, who's an audio drama supremo. He's like one of the guys. Like, he just wrote the Witness miniseries for Paramount. Mm-hmm. Brilliant writer. And I said, this feels to me like a great idea for a War of the Worlds style audio drama. And he was like, yes, absolutely. He bashed out an hour long, like two episode thing for his company, Gideon Media. And we recorded it later that year. Me and my friend Brian Silliman played the two roles. And I was immediately seized with this thought of like, well, I mean, God, what would it mean to make this be cinematic, a guy in a room? You know, how do you make this compelling? And I want, and that for me was a challenge that excited me. And my friend Patrick Terry, who is a great producer and a magician, he runs a company called Cinedata with J.D. Brin, who was the co-director of the film. And they were looking for fiction stuff to make. They usually make documentaries. And I said, well, have I got a pitch for you? Disaster movie in a guy's basement. J.D. pitched it much cleaner than that, which is to say a Duplass Brothers movie wrapped in a Roland Emmerich picture, which I think is very smart. But Patrick was so thrilled, and this was September of 2021, I think, when we talked. And by January of 2022, we were shooting. Mm-hmm. And this was at the height of Omicron. You know, Broadway shows were shutting down. Mm-hmm. And so the amount of people we had on set was very, very small. It was me, my co-director, JD, our cinematographer, Kevin Chu, our producer, Patrick, and James Colesby, who was just the guy who did everything. Mm-hmm. He built us an entire fake internet that we could use for the film. He built us an audio interface so that we didn't have to composite in any screens, because you can always tell when you're watching a movie and you're like, they pasted that screen in.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And they wanted me to have something to react to on screen. Like, I need a scene partner. And in this case, it's sort of the waveform and the EQ of this other voice, or like, you know, the gauge that shows how many people are listening, and the rolling scroll of phone numbers of people calling in. It was an amazing aid to actually act in the thing. But yeah, it was five of us shooting and essentially quarantining together for about 8 days in this place called the Mountain House up in Beacon, New York, in the middle of winter. You know, we had lighting equipment outside that had icicles on it. It was really, really fun. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I mean, the only thing that we shot that wasn't really in the house was like a small exterior in the forest by there. We had some drone footage that we incorporated and some stock footage. And we shot a little bit of my mother, Priscilla Goldfarb, who appears in some snippets and flashbacks as the main character's mother. Mm-hmm. She now has an IMDb page. She's thrilled about it. She said, should I get an agent? And I said, well, not no. She's very good. And she got to see it on a big screen. That's one thing I really cherish.
That's nice.
You know, they showed at the Bowery Film Festival in New York, and she got to go to the Regal Essex Delancey and see it on a big screen with big sound. And that for me was just, that was the prize. My mom getting to see her
that's
role on a big screen.
Well, that's great. I mean, getting this movie out there is, look, getting any indie picture out there is a enormous challenge. So walk us through the process of that. Like, you're at the Bowery Film Festival.
Yeah.
Were there others you applied to? You know, like,
oh, yeah.
Like, how did that whole process go?
Well, I think the trouble is we've democratized the means to create a film. We have narrowed the means to distribute it, mm-hmm. I think. That's sort of where we've gone. You know, the algorithm buries everything. Mm-hmm. But we started out our festival journey at the end of 2022. We had a cut of the film. It wasn't fully color corrected or fully properly mixed. But it got into the Seattle Film Festival, and we took three awards. We took director, actor, and the grand jury prize. And then we got kind of emboldened by that. We were like, oh, great. Let's apply to some more stuff. There was the Vancouver Independent Film Festival. There was the Brooklyn Science Fiction Fantasy Film Festival, the Bowery Film Festival. There were a couple of others. We were winning awards. And we thought, maybe there's a future for this picture. And in the summer of 2022, Alex Noe of Blood, Sweat, and Honey took an interest in being our sales agent. And I was expecting maybe two offers to distribute this thing.
Mm-hmm.
But we were fielding about a dozen.
Mm-hmm.
And that was incredibly gratifying. And we went with a distributor called Buffalo 8.
Okay.
And they're really great people. And they've done a lot in terms of, you know, scheduling it properly, getting it out there in the right channels, quality proofing it. You know, thanks to them, you know, we have a we have closed captions on the thing. And they're really, you know, we all sort of proofed them and worked on them. And, you know, their QC is pretty tight. So, yeah, it was actually a remarkably straight line for this thing. And now the trick is just getting eyes on it.
Right.
You know,
right.
And that's tough. And I will say, like, what you wrote in that article, it was incredibly generous and kind and helped us maybe get seen by a lot of people who wouldn't otherwise watch a film like this.
So this is another kind of question and difficulty, right? Mm. Is how do you get things out there to be seen by people? I mean, it's one thing to make it. Yeah. It's another thing to sell it to a distributor.
Yeah.
It's another thing to get it on Amazon, you know, and iTunes, wherever else, you know,
sure.
wherever it is. But then, you know, if people there's an infinite amount of stuff out there. The
yes.
scroll goes forever.
It's too much.
How do you get folks to actually sit down and watch it?
I mean, beg, plead, just like get out there and like see how many influential surrogates you have talking about the thing. And, you know, you just keep talking about it and you hope that you can make a dent. Listen, we're not doing crazy numbers. You know, I've seen sort of the first month's figures and people are watching it, you know. We got a long way to go before break even.
Sure.
Of course.
Sure, sure.
But we have a very good deal with Buffalo 8 in terms of, you know, the revenue split. So the hope is that this is a grower, you know. A big thing that I learned in speaking with Buffalo 8 about distribution tactics is you've got these three tiers, right?
Mm-hmm.
You've got PVOD, TVOD, and AVOD. Premium video on demand, transactional video on demand, advertised video on demand. Now, premium video on demand is stuff like Hulu, Netflix. You know, you've essentially been sold to it to a service, and that's a lot of money up front.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not doing those deals anymore because it's almost impossible to turn a profit with a streaming company.
Sure.
As evidence,
I'm sorry. Are you saying the distributors aren't doing those deals anymore?
Oh no, the streamers aren't doing the deals.
Yeah,
anymore. They're doing pickups for, you know, they'll do a $20 million pickup for a prestige picture.
Sure.
You know, with a name cast at a festival. What they're not doing anymore is shelling out for no-name stuff. And, you know, as much as I would love to pretend that I'm a grand celebrity, you know, Abe Goldfarb is not a brand name.
Sure, sure.
But, so PVOD was sort of never really on the table, I think. You know, we certainly were thinking, like, well, maybe Shudder, you know, maybe that would be fun. But I think everyone's tightening their belts.
Yeah.
So then you have, like, okay, well, TVOD... We've got it on Prime for rent or sale. We've got it on Vudu. We've got it on Comcast, Cox, Vubiquity, I think, are the services. But then eventually we're going to make our way to AVOD. And AVOD is stuff like Freevee, Pluto, you know. And increasingly, that's how people are watching.
Right, right.
There are independent filmmakers who were like, I'll tell you something, you're never going to hit break even on TVOD. On AVOD, that's where the money is. Because it's like going into a video store. It's a lot less like... this kind of algorithmically generated, you should watch this, that you see on a Netflix or a Hulu. On AVOD, by and large, it's just a random, motley assortment of stuff. And people be like, sure, click. And, you know, they've got ads in them. They're not necessarily ideally placed because they're not built for ad breaks.
Right, right, right.
But the funniest thing in the world to me is that the most immediately remunerative distribution channel is the one where they've rediscovered network television.
Right, or cable.
Or
it's
cable.
TNT, you know, late night TNT or whatever.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And there's money there.
Yeah.
And I know people who made films that I've never heard of who were like, yeah, we did numbers on there. And I think that's really extraordinary. And I think it speaks to the evolving attitude people have towards the streamers, which is to say, I do not actually care about the mode of conveyance here. And whatever you're doing to sort of monkey around with the user interface or, you know, how sort of catered this is to my theoretical interests, it doesn't matter. I want to go into a video store, aka one of these AVOD sites, find something I've never heard of, and then watch it.
Yeah.
And that's really exciting to me because that means tastes are once again diversifying. Because it's been a while since we had a monoculture, right?
Yeah,
what's
yeah.
the last monoculture event for you?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, you could make the argument that the Super Bowl every year is
sure.
the monoculture, right? That's
yeah.
like that is like the big
right.
big thing.
In but terms that's a thing, right?
Right. In terms of movies, I don't know, like the Spider-Man
probably
No Way Home probably is the last big
probably
art Barbenheimer.
Barbenheimer. Right? But even then, what a fluke that was.
Mm-hmm.
Like that's deranged.
Yeah.
That the big double feature of the summer was the very smart sort of feminist doll picture. And the R-rated, you know, let's talk for 3 hours movie about a nuclear fucking physicist.
Yeah.
It's such, they're both great.
Yeah.
I watched Oppenheimer again recently and I was just blown away by the fact that it feels about 10 minutes long.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think like even that, it was a fluke. It came out of nowhere. Whereas in the past, let's say the Harry Potter pictures,
mm-hmm.
Star Wars for a good long time, Lord of the Rings was a monoculture event. Everybody went to see those. But now everything is so atomized. Now everything is catered to the specific interests of, well, you watched this, let's narrow this down even more into a niche. And it's quite culturally isolating. And there was nothing more wonderful when I was a kid than going into a video store and seeing what they had, looking at the covers and being like, that looks cool.
Yeah.
And sometimes,
totally.
Sometimes you'd end up on a dog, but like, you know, by and large, it was a great experience discovering.
Well, and the other thing, you know, look, this is, so I've heard the exact same thing about AVOD streaming.
Sure.
That the advertising-based streamers are, A, doing an enormous... It's really like the dark matter of the streaming universe. Like, people yeah. don't really pay attention to, like, oh, what's on Tubi? You
sure.
know? But it's like, that's what's doing tons
it's
of numbers.
It's a huge sector.
It's huge. And because there is advertising within the thing itself, because you can, like, track, like, okay, this person, you know, 1,000 people have watched this show, they've all seen...
Right.
10 advertisements, you know, here's a check for whatever.
Yeah, you can't fuck with the money when it's right. advertising based. Like
right.
the metric is right there. I mean, the economics of most of these streaming services are going to be cloudy and mysterious, you know, till the end of fucking time. But AVOD, it's like, yeah, they watched
right.
this much
right,
and
right,
this
right.
many ads. And as a result, here's the revenue.
Yeah. I mean, it's a little bit like YouTube in that way, where YouTube has,
mm-hmm.
it's like you get so many views, so many ads on them.
That's right.
Whatever. Like, that's what it is. And it is interesting because I'm like, look, I am a rabid anti-advertising person in the sense that I pay for the higher tier on just about everything. Because
yeah.
I don't like ads.
Yeah. Nobody likes ads.
But that is like, that is, as you say, we are rediscovering that this is actually how, oh yeah, that's right. There's a reason they did this for 100 years.
Isn't that the thing though?
Before streaming.
Isn't that amazing? The fact that like everything we're getting back to now, like the end point of all of these like big technological innovations is we didn't really need that. You were polishing doorknobs, you know, the Titanic or whatever. Like what people want ultimately boils down to the stuff that always worked. You know, we're always talking about the death of movie theaters or whatever. Well, guess what? Anyone but you, $25 million rom-com with two people
yep.
who've never opened a movie on their own and are now, I think, officially stars. I think Glenn Powell and Sydney Sweeney, that is, listen, whatever you think of the picture,
yeah.
that's huge. It's made over $200 million worldwide.
Yeah.
And it's been playing since Christmas. And people are eager to see movies.
Yeah.
They don't need to be spectacle. They don't need to be appointment viewing. Sometimes it can just be, here's a durable genre with attractive people in it.
Right, right.
And we'll pay the $20 for a ticket.
Yeah. No, it is, it is, well, you know, it's wild how everybody has to relearn the same lessons over and over again.
The question is, when do we loop back on physical media? Because, you know, I think Matt Damon was on Hot Ones and he made this very good point. I don't know if you've seen the clip.
Yeah,
where he's just like, you had two opening weekends. You had theatrical and then you had DVD. Streaming wiped that out, basically. Well, I guess my question is, at what point, especially now that with licensing vagaries, stuff that you buy can just be taken away.
Yeah.
At what point do we see a resurgence there and just... Listen, I'm not a reject modernity, embrace tradition kind of guy, but
well, I'm
those models were sustainable.
Yeah. Well, look, I'm totally with you on that. I do think that the customers have decided, like, here's what you know what we want? We want something like Tubi where we can go and we watch something.
Yeah.
We don't. We watch a little bit of it. It's free. There are the ads.
Yeah.
Whatever. And I do think there is a market for physical media, but it does feel like it is evolving much more into a collector's medium.
It is.
Basically what vinyl was.
Yeah, like how Kino Lorber is putting out, you know, on 4K shit we've heard of, but no one else has.
Right. You know, like Vinegar Syndrome with
Vinegar
nice
Syndrome, Severin, you know,
Severin, you know, it's funny, I have basically taken to limiting myself to, like, I can buy, like, four or five of these collector sets a year, and that's we got to wait for everything else to come down in price a bit. But it's a huge problem for the industry because everybody shifted so hard to relying on that home video revenue.
Yeah.
From the box office, they're like, well, you know, if it doesn't make $100 million in the box office, that's fine because it'll make $40 or $50 million on DVD. We get more of that, you know.
Yeah, I mean, because you're not splitting it with the theaters. Mm-hmm. You know, I think a lot of people don't really understand. It's so funny when people talk about the economics of filmmaking, what they don't, people who are not intimately involved with it generally don't understand where the money goes. Mm-hmm. They don't understand that a studio is keeping about 50%, right? So 50% give or take goes to the distributors, half give or take goes to the people who actually put the picture out.
Right.
Or the exhibitors rather than the distributors. The exhibitors. Yeah. The exhibitors and the distributors. Right. But then there's, you know, marketing costs and there's back-end deals. There's first dollar deals, you know. And, you know, it's so hard to explain to people that a $100 million movie making $150 million has lost money.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's very difficult to explain it.
Yes. I bear this cross.
I know.
Frequently. Explaining to...
Your sacrifice is
noted. I have a rule that if you have not spent... if you didn't go to Box Office Mojo like five times a day during the before times back when it was good before.
Oh, God. Yeah. When they had like... Before, well, you had the budget listed. You had the... It's not a great site now.
Yeah.
But it was great.
Well, let me...
They don't list the budget anymore, which to me is such a fascinating thing to see next to the collection.
It is. Though I understand why they stopped doing it because the numbers are very unreliable. Sure. And you don't want to, like...
Well, there's reported budgets and there's...
People versus, sure. All right, so let me ask. And if you can't answer this, don't answer. Don't answer.
Please.
But let's say... all right, so the we've got First Time Caller on Amazon. Let's just say Amazon. It's on VOD on Amazon.
Right.
It generates $1,000 in sales.
Sure.
Just as a number. $1,000. What percentage of that goes to... Amazon, what percentage of that goes to the distributors? What percentage of that comes back to you guys?
I actually don't know how much of this I'm able to talk about.
Okay.
Just in a legal sense. I do know that we get a very good cut of it. Mm-hmm. You know, we haven't gotten our first check yet because we've only been out for about a month and a half. Mm. But no, my understanding is it's favorable. You know, it's different if you're on Prime, you know. Because if you're actually like on Prime, then it's sort of minutes watched and like it's all divvied down to the micro cent. Mm-hmm. You know, it's very difficult to say.
Yeah.
But that business end of it, I have an incomplete amount of information.
Sure.
And B, I'm not sure how much I can share.
Okay. But the point is,
yes,
people need to consider the various cuts everybody takes.
Absolutely.
Before you...
100%. No, the economics of this all are just deeply mysterious to most people.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now it's fun. You know, I do want to get back to the film because we were talking about atomized culture.
Yes.
And First Time Caller is so much. You really nailed it in what you wrote about it. That it's really about loneliness in this deeply interconnected age, and the ways that we reach out to each other for abuse when that's the only kind of connection we can find. You're also the only person who nailed down Brent's ideology, the main character's ideology, because in a lot of reviews, we've had people being like, well, Brent's obviously a right winger. And then other people were like, clearly a left winger. And I'm like, are you watching the movie? Because you nailed it. He's basically just about clicks, engagement, money. Mm-hmm. That's it. You know, and I was thinking about this as we had a little watch party of the picture last night on Instagram Live. We had a lovely bunch of people watching, asking questions. And it reminded me that, you know, in many ways, you can only really understand the art you make after you've gotten it out of your system, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, there's the impulse that drives it, an image or a concept that drives the actual making of the thing. But the reason every bit of art is a piece of like psychic autobiography is because so much of it is unintentional. It's just you, you're in it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And as I'm watching it last night, I'm thinking, you know, in this current moment of, you know, Thomas Friedman, you know, flat world, massive interconnectedness, we're sort of torn in three. There's three things to all of us. There's our personality, there's our persona, and there's our ideology. And these three things are either in concert or in conflict, right? We're being torn apart. Our personality is who we are. That's fixed. We can't change that. Our persona is what we choose to project. And our ideology is our belief system. Now, none of those things can be compatible if you're a human being. Ideology invariably runs into the problem of basic human hunger, desire, you know, flaws, even. So, like, your personality makes your ideology, on some level, impracticable. You know, there's, like, certain things you do have to stand firm on. Like, you know, obviously there are principles of behavior. But, you know, everyone's a hypocrite at one point or another because everybody changes every minute of every day.
Sure.
The persona is very nearly always a betrayal of the personality. You know, because we're now observed 24/7, because our life has to be so online, we're all projecting. We've all got an invented self. Everyone is an avatar of themselves now. And it's really fucking scary to just think about, man, you know, I grew up, I was born in 1979. I didn't have email till 1994.
Yeah.
I didn't have a cell phone till I was in my 20s. I don't understand how people don't go insane. And a big part of the film is just like, it is about people driven insane. You correctly observed that his cozy recording room comes to feel like a cell.
Yeah.
And that's it. It's because he's commodified himself.
This is interesting just in terms of the art of it. So, I mean, when you're sitting there, you come to this house and you're like, all right, we got to set up lights here. When you were doing the set designing, how much of that was like, all right, we want this to be sparse and empty versus like, it's easier to have it sparse and empty and moving around.
I get you. I mean, like, so we did want it to be sparse and we wanted it to have a lot of negative space. But a big part of giving it character and depth was the lighting. And that's down to Kevin Chu, our cinematographer, who is an unbelievably great lighter. You know, Kevin is a genius for it. And when we first came in, he was like, well, I can light about 90 degrees. And I was like, yeah, but how much more can you light?
Mm.
And we kept sort of expanding it until we had a truly obscene amount of freedom of movement with the camera. And that was a huge joy because my whole deal with it was I didn't want it to look like a thriller from the outset. If the whole thing looks kind of Spartan and cold, then you immediately know that something sinister is going to happen. I wanted to create a space that was sort of cushioned by warm lighting, which is then invaded by this unease and terror. And Kevin was brilliant with that. And JD was a remarkable collaborator in realizing like, okay, how do we make this feel inviting at the start?
Mm-hmm.
And then by the end, no matter how big and empty the room is, he is trapped in the corner. That was a very deliberate choice. Mm-hmm. He's not recording in a kind of open space. He's essentially segregated himself to this one corner of the room.
Mm-hmm.
And he's surrounded by, you know, pictures of his 1980s crushes, you know. And that's kind of it. He's got trophies. He's got his own posters. I think if you look closely.
His crushes and himself. Yeah.
Very notable.
Yeah.
After we finished shooting, our producer, Patrick, was like, do you want to keep this Brent Ziff poster? I was like, the fuck I do. I never want to look at this guy again. I want to shower this man off. But yeah, no, the design was a very conscientious component. I mean, like the first day we were in, we didn't shoot much in the room because we spent a lot of time dressing it. We got the exterior shots, you know.
Yeah.
But it was very, very deliberate, the design elements in this, with what we wanted to suggest with it.
Yeah.
If you look at the trophies that he's won, there's stuff like Red Pill Awards. You know, it's all very...
Yeah.
You can see like pull quotes on his poster, merciless, hilarious, and brave, which by the end he absolutely is not.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, that dressing the set was a great deal of fun.
How much do you consider this to be an I don't know, influenced by or an artifact of or just a part of the experience of the pandemic and like that kind of
it's inextricable.
Vibe we all had at that moment.
It is at its core inextricable from that time. I'm delighted by the fact that it doesn't seem to have aged because the stuff that Mac focused on in the writing, there is a mention of masks in large gatherings and that's still in the conversation. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's in terms of literal stuff in the script, I think it's going to be fairly permanent. You know, but the stuff that makes it an artifact of its time, obviously there's the tech, and there's the fact that it's born of that anxiety of isolation, lack of control, the ways in which we all kind of retreated into our enclaves. Mm-hmm. You know, no matter how connected we were, you know, through Zoom meetings or whatever, there was a sense that something had been chopped out of our lives, you know. I think it's inextricable from the pandemic, especially during Omicron.
Yeah.
When the terror of it all sort of flared up again, we're like, oh wait, this gets worse.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, and the mediation of all this through screens, him looking through his screen, us watching through our screens, in living through an era where, look, I work from home, I work from a remote location. When I have to have meetings with people, we do it via Riverside or Zoom or whatever. It is what it is, but it is also born of that era.
Yes.
Like in a very real way.
And there's no going back. There's no going back. You know, people always talk about getting back to normal. It's like, no, there's a new normal.
Right.
Anytime there's a mass disrupting event like that, frankly, a mass death event like that, yeah, you're not going back. Things have changed.
Yeah.
You know, you mentioned, you know, mediated through screens. The experience of watching the film is very different depending on the venue. Mm-hmm. Because I've seen it now with a crowd in a theater. Lots of laughs, lots of engagement, very, like, attentive, you know. And there's something rather cathartic and joyous in that experience. But then I have a friend of mine, Scott Brown, who co-wrote Beetlejuice. He watched it in his hotel room. And he texted me afterwards and said, I am fucking terrified. He was like, I had to look out the window sometimes to pull back the blinds and look out the window just to be like, everything's okay. And yeah, that's the difference. Watching it alone, which puts you, I think, right back in that place of there is a calamity just outside the window.
Yeah.
Whereas there is something more safe in your heart watching it with a bunch of people who can just laugh at the profanity and the sort of the big poop joke of it all.
It was funny. I think I may have mentioned this in my piece, but it would be a fun thing to watch with a crowd.
Yeah.
And not by myself in my room, just because I was curious how some of that played with large crowds.
It definitely hits the air in a cool way. You know, like I was really nervous. Because, well, you're nervous anyway, because you're like, how is this going to play to anybody who doesn't live in my brain? But it was really gratifying that people immediately cottoned on to like, okay, this is the tone. It's definitely, it attains a kind of gravity, but it starts out really as dark comedy. And it never quite lets go of that, even in its darkest moments, because, you know, it's a poop joke.
Yeah, that is, there is an extent.
Without spoiling what it is for anyone who hasn't seen it, it is built on the dumbest, dirtiest joke. And Mac Rogers, our writer, he said when he sent me the script, he was like, Abe is absolutely going to say no to this particular element. And that's exactly the thing that when I was reading it, I started shrieking with laughter in my apartment.
Yeah. All right, so that was pretty much everything I wanted to ask. I always like to close these interviews by asking if there's anything I should have asked, if you think there's anything folks should know about Beetlejuice the musical, first time caller, whatever, sure. Anything.
Well, I feel like first time caller, we've covered where you can see it, that you should see it, that it is, I think it's a terrific picture. I'm very proud of it. Beetlejuice, this is a tank that's going to keep on rolling. Something that I haven't seen a lot of hype about and that I wish people would go see, I saw this last week, a picture called How to Have Sex. Mm-hmm. It's a British film. Is a directorial debut for a director named Molly Manning Walker, who was previously, I believe, a director of photography. It is a gorgeous looking and deeply textured film about these three British girls who go on a holiday in Greece. And it's about social terror. It's about sexual assault. It's about consent. It is a a truly rattling and great work of art with astonishing work by a cast of very young people. I can't recommend it highly enough. It's not playing in a lot of theaters, but How to Have Sex, absolutely tremendous, and I really hope people watch that.
I believe that was a Draft House Recommends.
Was it? Oh, amazing.
So if you live near a Draft House.
Well, I can't disagree. But yeah, no, I mean, just keep going to the movies. You know, I want people to keep going out and having that experience together. That matters to me because, you know, what I want to do as I direct more pictures is make stuff that's certainly commercial enough to play on a big screen for a sustained amount of time. And I want people to share it. And there's nothing like it. There's nothing that good.
Yeah.
Similarly with Beetlejuice, I mean, God, keep going to the theater and keep making theater locally. You know, very often we'll have Q&As after the show and young people will be like, how can I be on Broadway? And my immediate thing is like, A, don't think of New York as the be all end all for art. Because it's not. There is art being made in every city and every state in America. And it's so important that we don't starve these community efforts by just having these mass migrations to the East and West.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think it's so important that art lives everywhere. And simultaneously, the best way to become a professional artist is to make things. That teaches you who you are. That teaches you what your point of view is. That lets you make things that are specific to you and interesting. And the most interesting work of art is an interested work of art. So whatever it is that you're fascinated with, that's what it is. That's what matters. That's what you should follow and chase. But yeah, I mean, not to be incredibly hippy-dippy about it.
No, that's good. It's good. We inspire the kids.
Absolutely. Get all the kids there. Who listen to your
get
podcast.
Out there. Get out there, kids.
Yeah, the 12 to 13 Sunny Bunch fans. Like
it's a narrow dynamic, narrow demographic, but they're there. Now, thanks for being on the show. Thanks for coming out here and talking to me today. We'll make sure to get folks to the theater. And again, if you want to watch the movie, just go to justwatch.com. You'll find someplace where it's playing on a service you have. So
I really appreciate you having me here today, Sonny.
Once again, I am Sonny Bunch. I'm culture editor at The Bulwark, and I'm very thankful for having Abe on the show. Thanks again.
Oh my gosh, thank you.
We will be back next week with another episode of The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. We'll see you guys then.